Hello, and welcome to another episode of MK Crypto Diaries. I am your host, Dr. Justine Sherry Herrera, and we are recording this episode today, the 4th of May, 2023. On the 14th of March of this year, the European Parliament adopted a report to pass a new Data Act, which includes a mandate for smart contracts. A new clause in the bill, known as the Data Act, requires all smart contracts to include a kill switch. While the intention of the regulators was to give people more protection over their personal information, the Act has generated some concerns in the Web3 community. Some fear a kill switch mandate would curb the decentralization of smart contracts by giving one person or a group of people the power to shut down operations. Others claim that this provision will lead to inevitable security flaws. Case in point, some people remember an incident that occurred in August when decentralized exchange Optify accidentally activated a kill switch to its mainnet, leading to permanently being shut down and losing 661,000 worth of USDC stablecoin tokens. So, what is the Data Act's mandate on smart contracts all about? Will the famous Article 30 compromise decentralization or security? Are these concerns legitimate concerns? Here with us to talk about this very hot topic, which has just arisen, is Dr. Matteo Alessandro, who incidentally is one of our very own associates here at MK FinTech. Matteo, thank you very much for joining us today to speak about this very exciting current topic. So let's get right into it. Can you please elaborate a bit on what this proposed EU Data Act is all about and also how a smart contract is defined under this Data Act?
So the EU Data Act aims to establish who can create value from data and how it works very much hand in hand with the GDPR regulations. And the aim, which is what the EU has been going for a while, is to balance the flow between the use of data while also protecting the privacy of the individuals as well as the security, safety and ethical standards of things. Now, in the initial Commission proposal, a smart contract was defined as a computer program stored in an electronic ledger system, where the outcome of the execution is also stored in the same electronic ledger system. And the definition of an electronic ledger system was actually taken from the EIDAS regulation.
The identity, correct?
Yes, the electronic identity regulation, which said it is a tamper-proof electronic record of data, providing authenticity and integrity, as well as a chronological sequence, obviously paraphrasing. And many have said that that is sort of looking towards DLT, even though it doesn't necessarily specify it, because this could also obviously refer to centralized systems. Mm-hmm. Now, the problem is that in the report that was recently adopted by the European Parliament, the definition of smart contract, which were under sub-articles 15 and 16, were actually removed from the Act, which is quite problematic, because obviously this is something that's very, very, very important to establish. It would also probably be very interesting to look at what a smart contract is, because a smart contract is a bit of a misnomer. It's not technically a legal contract. It's obviously a program, a set of lines that execute functions automatically. So, you know, there's no real definition for what a smart contract is. And more importantly, there isn't a definition for what a smart contract for data sharing is, because at the end of the day, this act does look towards regulating the transfer of data, the sharing of data, and how it's done.
Okay. So you're saying from this EU data proposed act, they removed the definition of a smart contract.
In the latest report published, it's been removed. Obviously, this is still subject to change.
Probably because they're going to revise it, I'm guessing. Not because they cannot obviously publish an act without giving the definition of a referred provision.
Ideally not. The legislative process is a very iterative one, after all. They could, for example, be looking towards using definitions which were implemented since then, for example, through the DLT pilot regime, through the Mika. So, you know, it's unsure. Obviously, it's a bit difficult to
obviously, understand. It would make sense to have the same definition within all these regulations and directives and proposals. Otherwise,
exactly,
it's not going to be harmonization.
Exactly.
All right. Okay. And so why do you think that the Data Act is addressing smart contracts? So sort of what are the intentions of the EU here?
So I think smart contracts have a huge potential for data utilization. Smart contracts aren't too different from a regular computer program. Obviously, it's the way that they run that's different, the fact that they're based on a distributed ledger. So at least the intention of the EU seems to be harmonization, to set standards for these smart contracts. There has been a bit of a comment from people within the Commission who have said that even though they are looking to harmonize and they are looking to standardize, the act itself has gone a bit away from what it was initially meant to do.
Okay.
But I think the aim, I think the idea is good, but obviously this needs to be done very, very carefully so as not to stifle innovation. That's the main issue with regulating tech, which all legislators face.
Agreed. So basically, in essence, the intentions from the EU, like they do with many other regulations and directives, is harmonization. So to have the same set of standards across the use of smart contracts. Now, the Data Act makes reference to four main essential requirements for smart contracts. Can you please give an overview of what these four main essential requirements for smart contracts are, as set out in Article 31 of the draft Data Act?
Okay, so the four requirements are, at least in my opinion, relatively vague.
Okay.
The first one is robustness and access control, making sure that there are rigorous access control mechanisms and a high degree of robustness. To give you an idea about what access controls are, effectively within any IT system, any IT infrastructure, you're going to have different levels of users. So you have your main user, your admin, your super admin. This is what access controls are, meaning that different people can execute different things. Robustness is a bit vague as a term. Obviously, smart contracts are subject to bugs. They're subject to vulnerabilities, which sometimes aren't within the smart contract code itself. This is what happened, for example, in the DAO hack, which everyone knows about, which wasn't an issue with the code of the DAO. It was an issue with the underlying infrastructure of Solidity and how it interpreted the code. The second and perhaps most controversial one, I'm sure we'll be speaking much more about this, is safe termination and interruption. And this means that there is a mechanism to terminate the continued execution of transactions which stops mistaken transactions. In fact, they use the term future accidental executions. It could either reset or instruct to stop or interrupt the action. So it either completely kills it or stops execution.
Is this the famous kill switch requirement?
Yes, yes. This is the one that's
AKA been kill switch. Okay.
Yeah. The third requirement is equivalence in the way that a smart contract affords the same level of protection and legal certainty as other contracts generated through different means. Even though this is a very nice idea and something which I believe would be ideal moving forward for both the legal and tech industries, there is no stipulation about how this is actually going to work. There's no stipulation about how it's going to interact with domestic law. There's no stipulation about what's needed. The fact that smart contracts can offer legal certainty is not new. The UK Jurisdictional Task Force, as well as the England and Wales Law Commission, did issue reports saying that a smart contract could be considered a legal contract if it contained all the requirements of a legal contract, being obviously consent, offer, consideration, and the agreement of the both parties. And the final one is the protection of confidentiality of trade secrets, making sure that the smart contracts are designed to ensure the confidentiality of trade secrets. Now, obviously, this is problematic in and of itself, because obviously, as we all know, the blockchain is public, at least up until now. The confidentiality of trade secrets, if posted in clear text, would be impossible to cover. However, obviously, there are still means for encryption, for using hashing, to be able to cover certain parts of the data, even though you could see how the smart contract mm-hmm. is working.
Amazing. Thank you. So to summarize, the four main requirements would be, as described by you, robustness and access controls. Second, safe termination and interruption, aka the famous kill switch requirement. The third, equivalence, so same protection and legal certainty across the board. And the last one, protection of confidentiality and trade secrets. Okay, so that's a great summary of what essentially Article 30 of this proposed Data Act is all about. Now, if we had to move towards enforceability, so are there any consequences for non-compliance in the proposal? And does the proposal shed any light on the matter of contract enforceability?
So for non-compliance, the Data Act makes reference to the GDPR provisions. Okay. So the penalties can go up to 20 million or 4% of total worldwide annual turnover of the previous year, whichever number being higher. Mm. Obviously, again, there are many things which are still up for debate, many things which still need clarity. Regarding contract enforceability, again, we need to make a distinction between a contract that purely serves a function and a contract that sets up an obligation between two parties. In the term of a contract that executes a function, obviously there's no legal enforceability in it per se. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But in terms of actual contractual obligations, well, again, it depends on the domestic systems. And this could come through the doctrine of procedural autonomy, meaning that every member state has the ability to decide on their own. But, you know, this can lead to a lot of questioning into the smart contracts. You obviously have the very, very clear problem that most people within a judicial setting would not be able to interpret the code. Mm-hmm. You could also look into, for example, can someone enter into a smart contract if they don't understand the code? Mm-hmm. Does that mean that they actually gave mm-hmm. their consent if they were mm-hmm. not in full understanding of the obligations? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it's a subject of academic debate, which has been very deeply investigated. Okay. But the proposal doesn't really look into that.
Okay, so here there'll be a big variety. So depending on the judicial civil law system of each member state. So obviously the civil contractual laws and interpretations of one member state can differ greatly from the other. So there's no sort of harmonization when it comes to non-compliance.
And the problem is that the Data Act doesn't really specify which smart contracts it's regulating. Mm-hmm. So does this apply to all smart contracts regardless of their nature? Or does it purely apply to smart contracts that are mm-hmm. made for the purpose of transferring data? Based on that, it's, you know, very left in air, because if this proposal will affect all smart contracts, that's obviously going to be a huge impact on the blockchain industry, and it's not something that should pass you know, as a single article within one act as a sort of throwaway provision.
Agreed. Okay, super. So moving on, now on the April 17th, 2023, so quite recently, Polygon issued an open letter on the concerns and potential implications of Article 30, which it just described in four main essential points of the proposed Data Act. The letter also showed that there was some backlash, from the community on these proposed amendments. What are some of the concerns highlighted, and would you agree that these are legitimate concerns after all?
So actually, the concerns from Polygon and the concerns from the internet community were different, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Let me start with the concerns that Polygon brought up first. And the first one is the clarification of the party offering. Article 30 states that the party offering smart contracts in the context of an agreement to make data available shall comply. And where if there is no particular party offering, then it is the person who is in the profession, in the industry of deploying smart contracts on behalf of people.
And so developers, for example.
Yes. And obviously, Polygon are saying that this should not be applicable to developers, because this would create a substantial restraint on them, and it should rather only apply to smart contracts in which there is a party offering and there is an actual centralized party offering, even though the actual smart contract, its actual execution might be decentralized. There would still be a legal entity, a group of persons who would be actually monitoring it, offering its services, etc. The second issue that they looked into is the clarification of a definition of the definition of an agreement to make data available. The definition of data is way too broad. This is not the first time this issue popped up. This is
the definition of an agreement
to make data available.
All right.
And the main problem is that data here is, again, paraphrasing, it's anything that's any record of anything. We already faced this problem with GDPR. Even though the GDPR had many, many beneficial sides to it, one of its biggest critiques is that it's far too overarching, far too broad, to the point that it's become nearly impossible to assess your compliance implications. Smart contracts share data by their nature. This is the basic point. As with any other computer program, you are sharing data. So what Polygon are proposing is that an agreement to make data available would only apply to contractual agreements between two enterprises, and it does not apply to smart contract-based agreements themselves. And also that the scope of data should be narrowed to personal data and confidential business data and trade secrets. So
it should apply and be limited to two enterprises as opposed to two individuals.
Exactly.
Okay.
In the same way that the GDPR does not apply to individuals.
Okay.
And obviously the narrowing of the of the scope rather than the definition would be very important, because if a smart contract is simply showing numbers which are not related to any individual or not, which are not related to any trade secret, any confidential information, it would not make sense to restrict it in a million ways. And then they look, they rather propose that this act should exclusively apply to permissioned contracts owned and operated by an enterprise or legal entity.
So therefore, it shouldn't apply to permissionless, so i.e. DeFi.
Exactly.
So should own, okay, fair enough.
So that way, it would allow service providers to provide their services in a completely decentralized manner, which is the approach that Mika took. So here we see a bit of a disconnect between two proposals, which are under the same strategy for the EU, where although one is pushing for complete decentralization, the other is regulating it in a way that would hold it back. On the other hand, the concerns from the blockchain community and also many other people who comment about these issues, well, you know, there's two sides to every story. There's the people who believe that regulation is meant to hunt them down, that it's meant to break them down, etc. I don't believe that's the case. There were people who were arguing that this would completely kill smart contracts. Again, I believe if the law is specific and the scope is adjusted well, then this should work well. And I believe that Polygon has made good proposals, because at least in my opinion, the law should never be ambiguous, because as soon as you have ambiguity, you have room for interpretation, and room for interpretation leads to either the abuse of that room for interpretation, the abuse of that room for interpretation, either by the regulatory authorities who use it to become extra regulated, or by individuals who wish to find the loopholes to work away. So, you know, I think these concerns are well brought up, especially on the side of Polygon, which are of a more technical nature. But there is also still time for them to be fixed.
Amazing. Thanks for that. So if I had to just summarize in a few points, some of the concerns addressed by Polygon and the blockchain community were that this proposal should not apply to developers in terms of who is offering or implementing the smart contracts. The definition of an agreement to make data available is too broad, And they think, and you also agree, that it should only apply to two enterprises as opposed to individuals. And also that these provisions should also only apply to permissioned contracts and not to permissionless, i.e. DeFi, which should also be more in line with MiCA. And I like the way you ended it, saying the law should never be ambiguous. Completely agree on that note. So if I had to move on and go back to the kill switch requirement, so can you really sort of highlight exactly and define, like in simple terms, what kill switch means? And also, a comment on Reddit states the following. The Data Act is going to hurt decentralized finance in Europe, as developers who want to create truly trustless platforms will have to block Europe on the front end, or they must create trustless protocols in secret. The Data Act hurts an already fragile ecosystem. The smart contracts can be trusted less without immutability. They become fragile and potentially much more risky to use. Another law by lawmakers who don't know what they are doing and in the name of helping hurt the industry as a whole. Now, some say that this kill switch is a common industry practice already, whereas others see this as a real game changer, since smart contracts are immutable. Can you elaborate on this point and explain what both sides are talking about? Because it sort of seems a bit contradictory.
So I think something that's very important to note, especially in the wording of the proposal, is that this kill switch function is meant to avoid future accidental executions. So in my opinion, a distinction needs to be drawn between smart contracts which execute imminently and smart contracts which are continuously executing. Obviously, for example, if you make a transaction on any DLT platform, that execution goes through immediately through a smart contract. However, if you have a smart contract that's constantly outputting data, constantly doing something, then in that case you could pause it. You know, this whole furore that's being put up is again an issue of not trusting regulators. In fact, the self-destruct function was an inbuilt function into Solidity, which is the programming language behind Ethereum. But it has been deprecated recently because of security concerns. There have been proposals put forward to delete it completely from the system in an upcoming fork, but they have not yet been implemented. And the reason that this self-destruct function was removed was because it was a very easy target for hackers. However, there are still ways to go about it. There are still ways to pause the implementation of a contract, and the proposed regulation also said that it should be assessed under which conditions non-consensual termination or interruption should be permissible. Obviously, this still leaves a lot to be desired, because who would be the party that's actually triggering this? Would it be the parties to the contract? Would it be authorities? Can it be done, you know, regardless? So it does lead to a number of issues. Now, when it comes to the issue of immutability, yes, the immutability of a smart contract, the immutability of the blockchain itself is one of the biggest things that it's based upon. But at the same time, there are still ways to do it. When you write a smart contract, you rarely write just one. You usually write at least two or three that work in tandem. And then you'd probably have one main contract which is calling the functions from these different contracts, and those are called delegate functions. So you could still have a system where you update these intermediate contracts. So this thing is already, you know, something that is technically possible in nature. The problem is, and this is probably a misconception, a lot of the blockchain community believes that blockchain is built on trust, and I agree. But I believe it should be built on technological trust, on the trust of the consensus mechanism, on the trust of the validators, rather than the trust of individuals. Not because you shouldn't trust people, even though I am admittedly a bit of a skeptic. It's more an issue of you're trusting the technology, you're trusting the code, you're trusting the numbers. It doesn't mean that someone else can't act maliciously on it. Now, the other issue that comes up is that smart contracts in and of themselves are rigid. What you can say in a contract, you can't necessarily say in code. And you obviously have the issue of the relatively large gap between legal and tech, where even though a lawyer would know how to draft the contractual side of things and the developer would know how to draft the function, they probably wouldn't be able to communicate between them to bridge that gap. In fact, in a paper that was recently published by Circiumaru, they proposed two solutions. Circiumaru et al. It's a Romanian name, so I'm I apologize in advance for any mispronunciation, but I did ask a Romanian friend just in case. So there's two ways to go about it, either classical contract law solutions where you go to court, or else including the contract law solutions within the smart contract itself. Mm. Now, if the argument is because a smart contract can be stopped and we shouldn't trust it, then we should trust no legal agreement that we've ever entered into. Because any legal agreement can be stopped if you have enough grounds for it. Mm-hmm. And again, even though smart contracts are technically tamper-proof, there are situations. However, this does go against the spirit of the blockchain, perhaps. It does go against the spirit of what was meant to be an interaction between two people that can't be changed. However, again, I don't believe that rigidity is the way forward. Law and anything legal is always a negotiation between two parties, and negotiations are always subject to change because conditions might change, issues might change, etc.
I'd say depending on the nature of the smart contract.
Of course. You know. Mm-hmm. In fact, there were varying inputs. Some people said that they believe that this is only applying to contracts related to data transfer, in which case then it shouldn't be an issue, because obviously if data is being transferred improperly, then you need to make sure that it can be stopped. While others are saying that this is the downfall of smart contracts as a whole.
It depends how it's going to be amended or passed or interpreted, if it's going to have a limited or narrow or wide interpretation and implementation.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And, you know, I'm very much pro-regulation as long as that regulation doesn't stifle the innovation.
Yes. Okay. No, amazing. Sounds like a complex issue and point with different interpretations and responses depending on who you speak to. So you're saying that the skill switch is meant to avoid future accidental situations. And in short, it's not a game changer and will not kill DeFi, depending on how and where it's applied. And also if certain solutions, such as you mentioned, intermediate contracts are applied. So there are some ways to circumvent some negative consequences of the kill switch.
Of course, because at the end of the day, regulation is aimed at protecting those who it's subject to. And in the same way that I want smart contracts to grow, etc., if my data is being transferred improperly, say it's being published online, I'd want a way to stop that. I wouldn't want something that's completely immutable. And it is also to be noted that the provision looks towards the interruption of the smart contract itself. It doesn't look at erasing anything that's happened before. So there would still be a record. There's still that level of immutability. It's the code of the smart contract that would be subject to that. The problem that I foresee is obviously every blockchain uses a different language. Layer one blockchains usually use a specific language. Ethereum uses Solidity. Polygon, which is a layer two above it, also uses Solidity. Blockchains like Solana use Rust. So the problem is making sure that these languages have the capacity for that, because obviously a computer language can only work in X amount of ways and you can't just change it because the law says so. So I think there should be a bit more input from technological aspect. Unfortunately, legislators are very rarely coming from a technological background, because let's admit it, it's mostly legal people or politicians that get there. And this discourse is, in my opinion, very important, because the technological community has a lot to offer. And unfortunately, I believe they may not always be as vocal as you'd want them to be. Obviously, Polygon have issued an open letter, but there's millions and millions of devs around the world who I'm sure could contribute. Yes. Obviously, not all of them, but this input would be needed to make sure that it's being implemented properly.
Oh, understood. Completely agree. I mean, education and communication is definitely the basis for any new regulation. And it seems that this new proposal has some positive aspects, some negative aspects, some controversial aspects, some ambiguous aspects. So we'll see where it will go. And on that point, sort of, what stage are we at? This is just a proposal, right? So how do you think these amendments sort of can be improved, and when will this proposal go to the next stage and eventually maybe become an act? Sort of, can you give a bit of a background of the stages to this proposal, you know, effectively actually passing as law, and you know, how many stages of potential amendments, modification can we see before it actually gets there?
So let's look into the legislative procedure first. Acts under the EU, except under very exceptional circumstances, need to go through what's called the ordinary legislative procedure. In this procedure, the Commission makes the proposal, because the Commission has the sole ability to make the proposals. This proposal is then usually forwarded to the committees, which review it and go through it and maybe even propose amendments. And that report from the committee is then sent to the Parliament, the European Parliament, which can choose either to adopt it or to amend it. And in this case, it's been adopted. So in this case, we're at the process. In the process, we're in the first reading by the Parliament.
First reading.
But it's good to notice that the first reading sort of works in tandem. The two legislative arms of the EU are the Parliament and the Council of the European Union. That's usually called the Council of Ministers, not to be confused with the European Council, but that's a whole other issue. Mm-hmm. And the Council of Ministers is made up, obviously, of the ministers of each member state, and there's different formations that it can sit in depending on the area. So at this point, this proposal will go to the Council of the EU, and they will choose either to accept it, in which case it would go ahead to become an act, or it would be it can be amended, and then it would go to the second reading. Mm. In the second reading, unlike the first reading, there's a bit more limitation, where there's a deadline for 3 months for the votes to have passed. And if there's still disagreement there, then it goes to the third reading, which is when the Commission gets involved to act as the mediator between both to try to find a solution. Because if it doesn't pass at the third reading, then it's completely off the table.
So where we are right now is first reading at European Parliament, and it could be there a second, third, fourth reading, you know, proposal.
Up till the third. After the third, it's put aside and it's not accepted. So usually what happens between both the first and the second, and the second and the third, is what's called a trilogue, which is where representatives of all three institutions involved, the Commission, the Parliament, and the Council of the EU, meet informally, and they negotiate between them. Now, these have been critiqued as not being very open door policy, not being very public, but at the end of the day, they are effective. So yes, that would probably happen in between, because obviously the EU doesn't want all this work to have gone down the drain.
Mm-hmm. So there is some hope for these suggestions and, you know, constructive criticism points being modified or changed and, you know, taken into consideration for, let's say, the second reading.
Yes, of course. I mean, again, the law is a very iterative procedure. Mm-hmm. Unless you have a stupidly high majority in any parliament, the first draft will very rarely ever look like the finalized text. This happened with Mika. Myself, the initial proposal of Mika had a million and one criticisms of it, and then, you know, you see them being amended.
Yes.
So hopefully the lawmakers will push for taking these issues into consideration. It's something that I am confident will happen, because Thierry Breton, who's an EU commissioner, has said that even though what the Act is trying to do is beneficial, it has strayed away from its initial purpose. So there is also the willingness of the Commission to intervene, unofficially, of course, because at this point it's out of its hands, but it still has a sway over the matter. Working off that, something which, you know, there's many areas which can be improved, most specifically the specificity, the narrowing of the scope, and something which should definitely be considered is the way that these contracts will interact with domestic law. Apart from that, a very interesting point that was brought up in the same paper I mentioned before was the use of oracles. Oracles are data points which blockchains usually call upon. Now, these oracles can go from telling you the time, to telling you the weather, to telling you what the stock price of something is. And the Act does not consider it. And the Act does not consider the regulations put on oracles to make sure that they're giving proper data, which then computerized data can be based upon, which is something that should very much be within this Act because it's within its remit. And in my opinion, again, it should be specified that this applies to smart contracts within within the data sharing, the data transferring industries. You can't regulate smart contracts based on one article with one sub-article, and you know,
yes,
that's not the way it goes with something as complex as DLTA smart contracts.
Those are some very you know, positive amendments and modifications, which hopefully will be taken into consideration. Now, thanks so much, Matteo. It was really insightful. I think you've provided a world of value on this very current hot topic. And before I let you go, as per usual, I would like to invite you to participate in a round of I Call Bullshit. So, Matteo, according to Eric Schmidt, the CEO of Google, the world's largest index of the internet estimated the size of roughly 5 million terabytes of data. So that's over 5 billion gigabytes of data, or 5 trillion megabytes. Schmidt further noted that in 7 years of operations, Google has indexed roughly 200 terabytes of that, or 0.004% of the total size. Do you think this is bullshit or not?
I think it's true, based on the fact that Google only indexes searchable data. It's not looking at file sharing, etc. So I think that sounds well. I mean,
yes. Yeah, so in fact, according to data provided by Google, this is true. So yes, I mean, a world of data, and it's just going to keep expanding to God knows how much the speed of light. So Matteo, thank you so much for joining. It's been a real pleasure having you on. And to you, the listener, stay tuned for our next episodes, which will also form part of our regulatory mini-series, where we will first talk about the current US crypto regulatory affairs. So a lot to talk about on that topic. And also we will be covering the new EU DLT pilot regime. So thank you for listening, and until next time, take care.